My name is Charlie. We're in the book of Judges, and let me tell you something. Judges are a book about the repeated stories of God stepping in and rescuing. But it's also another story. The book of Judges really is a story of what godly leadership is supposed to be and what it looks like. Last week, we looked at a guy named Ehud. He's called the left-handed assassin. True story. I made an 8-year-old left-handed boy cry. Didn't mean to do that, but God loves left-handed people. If I didn't say it last week, he made you special and unique, right? And so we looked at how God uses left-handed people, and in the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, that wasn't a compliment. They used that to talk about a deformity, and we said God rescues in unexpected ways. He uses unexpected people in unexpected places, and his rescue still shines through. Today's a little different. Today's story centers around the idea of what godly leadership looks like and then what it can do when the people of God step up and lead. Leadership, as I studied this week, as I read this week, is really all around us. Last year we talked about it in a positive way, and we said that you and I were meant to follow. We're designed that way. We're born that way. From the moment you enter this world, you are following something because it's a deeply seated desire built into you. My kid will be here in T-minus 6.5-ish weeks. And let me tell you something. Two of the most terrible and beautiful phrases are, you're going to have a kid and they will be just like you, right? Some days I'm like, I'm going to have a kid that's going to be just like me. And some days they're going to be just like me. I want to run. They're going to make the decisions I've made. They're going to be the best of me and the worst of me. And hopefully they have better sleep patterns than me. My point simply is we are meant to follow. And I'm about to learn a different aspect of what leadership looks like when I have a kid. I think you broaden it outside of just the family aspect. You look at Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and God said, I'm placing you in a garden. Every day you follow me. Every day you follow my example. Every day you follow my rhythms. Every day you follow my goodness. And as you do that, those things which I put in this place to follow you will then see me. We were made to follow, not just you and me, but dogs and cats and not snakes. We talked about that last week. They're awful things. But everything else is made to follow. Today's idea, today's point, one of the themes that we see running through the story of Deborah is what happens when leadership fails, what happens when leadership steps up and follows God. Martin Luther King Jr. came up this quote that we probably all heard before, said the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And this week as I read, and this week as I thought, and this week as I studied, this idea of what happens when Christian men and women, people that follow Jesus, what happens when they don't step up? And that's where we find ourselves in Judges chapter 4. So if you've got a Bible, open it up. In Judges chapter 4, again, we have this cyclical pattern to our stories every week. And as we kind of go through our stories, we find this pattern of what we see in the first verse of Judges chapter 4. It says, kicking off, Now the Israelites again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud's death. So Ehud, the left-handed assassin, he died. And after he died, Israel did what Israel did in the entire book. And this is the beginning of our cycle once again. First, we forget. So Israel had a leader they could look to that modeled Jesus, that modeled, in their respect, the goodness of God to them. And as long as they could look at that person, as long as that person was alive, as long as godly leadership was present in their lives, they followed well, and they reaped the benefits of that. But then when that person died, they forgot. And then it began all over again. And as they forgot who God was, as they forgot that God was good, as they forgot that God was faithful, as they forgot that God delivered, as they forgot the stories of God's rescue, as they grew distant from the things that reminded them how good God was to them, their forgetfulness led to unfaithfulness. It means that I forgot the stories of how God delivered me, and hey, this thing looks like it can deliver really well. Looks like the God of the Canaanites in our story today. And so as they forgot, they became unfaithful to God, and they subbed in other gods. Their passions went other places. But that unfaithfulness led to consequences. As they followed other gods, they would be handed over to the people they followed because they were not nice people for the most part. And so as they followed in the ways and the rhythms of the people around them, slowly but surely, those people would take them over. In this case, it's after about 80 years, and they'd become oppressed once again. But then at the end of all of our stories is this simple idea that the grace of God never forgets and always rescues. It's a pattern of the book of Judges. And so we start with that pattern yet again in verse 1. The Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight after Ehudah died. Verse 2, the Lord turned them over to King Jabin of Canaan, who ruled in Hazor. The general of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Higgalim. The Israelites cried out for help to the Lord because Sisera had 900 chariots with iron-rimmed wheels, and he cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. So what the text is doing is it's talking to us about how bad the oppression was. And in chapter 4, it says that, let me give you a benchmark, this group of people, this army had 900 iron-rimmed chariots, and you and I are listening saying, okay, so what? Back then and there, the iron-rimmed chariot was the most advanced military warfare unit you could have. What we're dealing with in our story is really a small piece of Israel with three distinct locations. You had a mountain, you had a plain, and you had a river. They're all going to come into play in our story. A mountain, a plain, and a river. And the plain was where the people grew crops. The plain was where the people succeeded, and the chariots in the middle of plains would do quite a bit of damage. 900 iron chariots would mow down Israelites, and they couldn't stop it. They weren't wood. They couldn't set them on fire. They were iron chariots. Chapter 4 and chapter 5 in Judges tell the same story. Chapter 4 is prose style. It's more how I like to speak. It's rational. It's chronological. It gets to the point and gets there quickly. Chapter 5 is sometimes how my wife likes to speak to me, which is beautiful and eloquent, but sometimes adds a lot of details. Chapter 4 is kind of the rational approach to the story that just lays it out. Chapter 5 is a poem. And there's a difference in those two things, and they're both beautiful. Chapter 4 tells the story. Chapter 5 embellishes on the story in chapter 4. It's a lot like, I don't do well, we've talked about this, with saying the L word. I don't like saying I love you. It makes me feel icky inside, working through it. Give me 6 weeks, all right? And so some people, when they say I love you to me, I will look at them and I will say I like you a lot, right? And I mean I love you, but that's just what I can do right now. And then you have other people that instead of saying, I love you, say phrases that to me make no sense, that are more poetic, like, I love you to the moon and back, right? One, that's not even possible, and two, that seems dangerous, okay? But people say that phrase, and I'm like, I like you a lot, and they're like, I love you to the moon and back. And we just miss each other. That's the difference between chapter 4 and chapter 5, and we're going to bounce between the two. Chapter 4 tells the story plain, down, and dirty in chronological order. Chapter 5 is the embellishment of this is how the story made me feel when we were living it out. So chapter 4 says we are oppressed by 900 iron chariots. Chapter 5 says it a different way, talking about the plight of the people here. In verses 6, 7, and 8, it says, in the days of Jael, caravans disappeared. Travelers had to go on winding side roads. Warriors were scarce. They were scarce in Israel until you, talking about Deborah, arose. Skips down. But I swear, not a shield or spear could be found among 40 military units, 40,000 troops. They're saying it had gotten so bad and they were so afraid that they didn't go into main places, that they took only side roads when they traveled. They didn't go out in daytime. They couldn't maintain jobs. And they didn't even see any kind of hope of a mounting insurrection because there were no weapons in the entire land. One theologian said, during the days of Shamgar and Jael, the Canaanites were so strong that the people with the birthright to the land feared to go out on the main highways. Instead, they traveled the back roads to avoid molestation. Peasant farmers could not raise or sell crops because of the Canaanite threat. They stopped working because of the Canaanite oppression. It's painting a very, very dark picture of a hopeless people. And they're hopeless because of their sin. That's what brought them there. In fact, they forgot who God was. And it slowly led down this path where they didn't see any other way out. And as we've studied Judges, we don't just learn about God's rescue or about the people that he uses. We learn bits and pieces of the fundamental nature of sin. And a good way to describe that word, because it carries so much context from your spiritual background, sin are the things that opposes the good ways of God in any way possible. right? So if God says be loving, it's not that. If God says be kind, it's not that. It's the opposite of God's intention for you and for me. That's what sin is. And so when they went against his intended purpose, they reaped the consequences of it. And we learn about it. In the first week, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, when we talked about the cycle of sin, we saw that sin necessarily wasn't subtle. That sin's purpose is never ever just to be there in the background, but it completely captivates. And every time we see them fall into sin, we see sin not just like hanging out on the sideline, but taking over the entire people like it did here. Sin's role isn't just to be there, it's to take you over. It's true then, it's true now. Last week we talked about Ehud a little bit. We talked about the sin of the people, and it said in the Ehud narrative that sin was oppressive. And what you do when you push past the initial observation of sin being a single split-second decision, like I made this one mistake, and Scripture lays this out in further chapters, especially the New Testament, is that sin is not a single decision. It's a system of oppression. It weighs down on you. It weighs down where you feel like you have no other way out and there's nowhere to go. It's not just one decision. It's a pattern and a rhythm. So sin is a pattern and it's a rhythm that tries to captivate you. And here it says at the beginning of our narrative, they once again did evil in the Lord's sight. And what we kind of see through this narrative is sometimes we have this idea that sin is in some way sexy, that it's exciting, that it's fresh, and that it's new. But when you push past that, you see the very real nature that sin isn't exciting, and it's not sexy, and it's not new, and it's not fresh. It's very, very stale. Lust is lust is lust. And there's something even more oppressive about knowing that tomorrow you can't change it. You're just going to fall into the same stale pattern and ways, again, that lead to oppression. It's the picture it's painting. They can't get out of their own way. They don't know where to find a weapon because they haven't seen one in years. They can't farm. They can't hope. They can't create currency or money, and they have nowhere to go. This is Israel when Deborah rose up. It's a sad, sad place to be, and nobody's doing anything about it. Enter Deborah. Look at verse 4 with me. So it says, now Deborah, a prophetess, this is after 20 years of life this way, a prophetess and the wife of Lebadoth was leading Israel at the time. She would sit under the date palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the Ephraimite hill country. The Israelites would come to her and have their disputes settled. So a couple things we know about Deborah right up front is we know that Deborah was, it says, a prophetess. And if we don't know what a prophetess was, it's the female version of a prophet. There are three different females in the Old Testament, one in the New that is labeled as a prophetess. And essentially, the role of the prophet wasn't just to hang out and talk about God. The role of the prophet was to speak for God to the people of God. It's a little different than pastors. It's way different than pastors. We dive into the text together. The prophet was the single spokesperson for God to God's people before God indwelt his people. My point there is it came with significant authority. When a prophet spoke, you listened. That's it. When a prophet spoke, you didn't try and catch it the next day. You didn't say, well, see, if my friends live this out. When a prophet spoke, you listened because it wasn't them speaking. It was God speaking through them. The entire country had recognized her as a prophet, and that carried with it authority. Secondly, we see that she was a judge. And so we're in the book of Judges, but judges were all over the land. It was built into how God said do life in the Old Testament covenant in the first five books of the Bible. He lays it out. He says, you're going to have some judges, and they're going to be all over. These are like magistrates. Because when you have conflict, and you will have conflict, when you have conflict, you're going to take your conflict to a judge. And that judge is going to try and resolve it. And there were layers of judges. And it'd keep knocking up. It's like our court system. And so Deborah was a well-known judge. And where it says she made her camp was accessible from the entire country. And people would come up to her and they'd say, we have a problem. And they'd seek her wisdom, her guidance, and her counsel. So we know some things about Deborah. One, is that she clearly was speaking from a place of authority. Two, that people respected her because they kept coming to her. And three, she clearly operated in and doled out wisdom. Deborah was pretty special. And I'm going to stop here just to make a side note. Sometimes when I've heard this story told, I hear people stop and say, God used Deborah as a judge because there were no qualified men in the land. That is not in our text here. That's nowhere in our text here. It doesn't say, well, all the guys were busy, so God defaulted to plan B. That is not in our text. What it says is Deborah was exceedingly capable. She was exceedingly wise. She was a prophetess from God, and she spoke for God. What it says is God uses people that he's given gifts to regardless of gender. What it says is that Deborah was capable because God made her capable. This isn't a story of God saying, well, there were no guys, they were all busy, so let me use some women. That is not what the story is saying. We can have a chat about gender roles in churches. It's just not today's chat. Today's is about what leadership looks like. Today's is about how God uses your gifts and mine regardless of your gender and how we see God's rescue as we step into those roles. So we see Deborah sitting under a tree, leading the people, speaking with the authority of God. And it's been 20 years. And then we find another guy, his name's Barak. Keep reading with me. Verse 6. So Deborah, she summoned Barak, son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali. She said, is it not true that the Lord God of Israel is commanding you? Go, march to Mount Tabor, there's your mountain. Take with you 10,000 men from Naphtali and Zebulun. I will bring Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, with the 900 iron chariots. And you, to you at the Kishon River, there's your river, along with his chariots and a huge army. I will hand him over to you. Barak said to her, if you go with me, I will go. But if you do not go with me, I will not go. That moment is an interesting one to me. I don't think it's Barak saying that I don't believe God is good or God will deliver or God will do X, Y, and Z. This is the point in our story in the cycle of the judges when God calls a judge and then God says, I will go with you. I think what Barak is doing is simply saying, I know you're the prophet from God and I need God to go with me if this thing is going to get done. So he looks at Deborah and he says, I'll go, but you have to go with me, even if, the verses above, God has called me to command these troops. What we get from Barak is not what we got from Deborah. What we get from Deborah is stepping into leadership to free her people, and Barak hesitates. I don't blame him, you know? I don't blame him. We talked about people stepping into places God has called them. And usually that's not a comfortable place. Usually when you step into places that you feel the Holy Spirit's leading you, it's hard and it makes you feel hesitant because most times you don't know if you're capable of it. One of my favorite things over the past 6 or 7 years here, I forget when it was years ago, in about 6 weeks, I can just say pre-baby and that makes sense to everybody. But one of my favorite things has been, we used to take teams to go teach in Africa. And teaching in Africa was great. My favorite part of those trips wasn't the African pastors. It wasn't the plane ride that was 14 hours. It wasn't learning about all the things we were going to teach. My favorite part was to go up to people and say, hey, you want to come teach some pastors in Africa for 6 days, about 10 hours a day with me? And at first they'd look at you like you thought they were someone else. They would look at you like, I don't know who you're seeing here, but my name is Pete, and that's not what I do. And you'd say, yeah, but it can be what you do. And they'd look and they'd say, I don't have the training, I don't have the tools, and they'd list these things, reasons why when God says, step up, lead, and go, they say, I can't, I'm not ready, there's no way I can do this. So I've said this before, but I don't like telling people I'm a pastor because it just gets awkward right after that. Either people have baggage and they blame me for it, or they try to prove to me that they're a good Christian. And all those things are fine, but it just is a conversation killer when you're trying to order appetizers at dinner. So I think one of the excuses I've heard quite a bit, especially when you do ministry, because in the States we pay pastors, and I'm thankful for it, but people look and they say, I'm not a pastor. I'm not trained. I didn't go to school for that. I'm a finance guy. I do finance, you do ministry, God's good all the time. The problem I have with that is it's not necessarily the model God has ever used, especially in the New Testament. In the New Testament, we see a different way God relates to his people, and it's not through a prophet, and it's not through a judge, and it's not through a general. It's through all of us. It says in Timothy that there is one mediator between God and mankind, and that's Jesus. That means we all have the same access to God. It's called the priesthood of all believers. It says in Corinthians 5, we are therefore Christ's ambassadors. As though God were making his appeal through us, we implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. What that says is that you and me, whether my job is pastor or your job is accountant, we are to be calling people into the goodness of God's rhythm and ways. This summer, one of our classes is going to be kind of how we do work and how we integrate our faith into our workspace, because there is not a sacred and a secular. There is not church and my real job. There is none of that. Everywhere we go as followers of Jesus is sacred because we take the Spirit of God with us. He has called us to lead. Brock didn't get that. He looked at Deborah and he said, I don't know if I can do this. That's kind of your role. I need you to go with me. So Deborah in verse 9 says, I will. She said, I will indeed go with you. Verse 10, Barak summoned men from Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. 10,000 men followed him. Deborah went up with him as well. Verse 11, Now Heber the Kenite had moved away from the Kenites, the descendants of Hoab, Moses' father-in-law. He lived near the great tree in Zinanim near Kadesh. That verse, it seems like, I love this verse. It seems like the writer just got a little ADHD on us. It's like, okay, we're talking about these people, and then you throw in this one, and then we're going to go back to these people, but it comes back a little later on. So what happened was Deborah went to Barak. She said, we're going to deliver these people. Barak said, I needed your with. She said, fine, but you could have done this on your own because God is with you. And then he starts rallying the troops. He starts getting people together. He goes from tribe to tribe to tribe and says, guys, we have a job to do. One of my favorite movies of all time is Newsies. I can sing you all of the words and still do some of the dances. And some of you are like, that does not surprise me at all. One of my favorite scenes is at the very beginning when they decide to go on strike and get Jack Kelly. And that dude goes from the five boroughs of New York City. He says, guys, come join our efforts. And four of the five say, yes, let's go. And one stops and says, maybe not. That's what's happening in our story, is the general is trying to rally the troops to step into and lead his people against the army that is not of God. And most of them say, yes, let's go. If you go to chapter 5, I'll read it for you. In verses 14 to 18, it's a more indulged account of him gallying support. In verse 15, it says, but the tribe of Reuben, there was great indecision. Why did you sit at home among the sheepfolds to hear the shepherds whistle for their flocks? Yes, in the tribe of Reuben, there was great indecision. Gilead remained east of the Jordan. And why did Dan stay home? Asher sat unmoved in the seashore, remaining in his harbors. But Zebulun risked his life, as did Naphtali, on the heights of battlefield. What the text is saying, what's happening in our story, is you have a good bit of people that are rallying around the cry to step up and lead his people out of oppression, but some still don't. You have three tribes that sit there and say, yeah, you know what? It's just not a good time for me right now. We got some sheep. There's a river. And those things were true. There's good reasons they had for staying at home, but when God called, they didn't step in and lead. They rather sat idly by and were complacent. Our story today is one of godly leadership, not of godly complacency, because he calls us to action. One commentator said it well. He said, a voluntary lack of fellowship with other believers will inevitably produce a lack of enthusiasm for God's work. So Barak and Deborah, they rally 10,000 troops, and they get to this plain. And so what happens is the king sees all of these men mount an army and move, and he says, they're going to start attacking us. So he commands the 900 chariots. He says, go and slaughter them because they're coming after us. So when they see the people move, in response, the chariots get up and go. Look at verse 14. It says in verse 14 that Deborah finally, once again, looked at Barak and said, spring into action. For this is the day the Lord is handing Sisera, that's the general, over to you. Has the Lord not taken the lead? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. I love that phrase, verse 14, it says, so spring into action. This is Deborah commanding Barak, spring into action, for this is the day that the Lord is handing him over to you. Has he not taken the lead? A couple things noticeable happen there. One, the first time God called, Barak said, yeah, I don't know, let's tap the brakes. The second time, Deborah said, go. He said, let's go. Spring into action. Do you not know that the Lord has gone before you? I think godly leadership, first and foremost, inspires others to join in the efforts. A couple years ago, probably 5 or 6, you know, there are a handful of times that I've done ministry when you look back on days, you look back on nights, on services, and you just know that God's in the middle of all of it all the time, but it's just good. You look back and you know out of nowhere a movement of God happened, and usually that's accompanied by tears, good tears. And there was the first time I experienced this was, man, 7 or 8 years ago doing some ministry with a friend. And we were doing some high school stuff, and the student started at this camp we were at, and they just started singing these songs. And like one by one, these kids started to flock in. Before you know it, there's a couple hundred kids in this room, and man, God was just moving. It was undeniable, out of nowhere. It was beautiful, and then at one point, this kid that started the worship came over to my buddy who was leading the ministry, and he said, hey man, you wanna step up and say some things? And here's something that probably is good and probably is bad about pastors is we like to be in the middle of stuff, you know? Some guy asked me yesterday, a friend of mine, he said, I don't know how you do what you do. I said, what do you mean? He said, get up for 35 minutes and talk to people. I said, you gotta be a little narcissistic. And I said, you trust that God speaks through you. But we like to be in the middle of it when we feel God moving. That's why we got in this game, is to help and inspire others. And my buddy, who was a really beautiful moment, and when I remember, because I would have been like, I'll go. Let me go. Let me talk right now. Let me, he said, why don't you do it? You started this thing. He inspired others into action. He called somebody else into leadership when he could have taken that over himself. That's what Deborah does. Deborah says to Barak, it's time for you to go and defeat this army. It's a beautiful picture of what godly leadership looks like. Where he was cold, now he is hot, and she inspired him into the call of God's rescue with her people. And secondarily, it says, has the Lord not taken the lead? I love that phrase there. I think that sometimes we put God in boxes that make sense to us and that's good. Because God is a complex God with different characters and emotions just like you and me. So we come to church on Sunday morning and we see a God who is compassionate and kind and loving and embracing and accepting. All those things are true. The flip side of that though is God is also a warrior. I mean, that's kind of what the text is implying here. Has the Lord not taken the lead in handing him over? That God is also a fighter. Because here's what we see in the book of Judges time and time again is God doesn't just do the touchy-feely, but God defends his justice. Because if he didn't fight for his justice, then he doesn't ultimately believe it's good for everyone. He says, no, this is what justice is, and it's worth fighting for because that's what I am. There was a story I read this week about Teddy Roosevelt. President, fought battles, big military war hero. And when he was at Harvard, he taught a Sunday school class. And there's this kid, I don't know how old the kid was, 8, 9 years old. He walks into the Sunday school class, and the kid had a black eye. And Teddy Roosevelt said, what happened to you? And the kid said, there was another boy pinching my sister and I punched him. And Teddy Roosevelt said, well done, here's a dollar, right? My point there is not that we should teach our Sunday school teachers to tell kids to deck other kids. My point is, and Teddy Roosevelt after that got let go from the Sunday school services like we would do here at Crossroads. But the point of the story is that Roosevelt was excited for a kid that defended justice because that's what God does. Now, I don't think God calls us to do it by punching someone, by the way, but it's a beautiful picture that God fights for these things like he did here. And we have to balance the beauty and generosity and love and accepting part of God with the fact that God fights for his justice. And that's what he did on that day. Keep reading with me. In verse 15, the Lord routed Sisera in all of his chariots, in the army with the edge of the sword. And, Sisera jumped out of his chariot and ran away on foot. It says not even one person survived. That word routed there means panicked. So what happened was, long story short, it says it in chapter 5, verses 4 and verse 20. It says, the earth shook, the heavens poured down rain, the clouds poured down rain. The Kishon River carried them off, the river confronted them, the Kishon River. What happened there? They were panicked because all of a sudden there seemed to be this flash flood in the middle of this plain that wiped away the chariots. God used what was their strength and made it their weakness. Chariots are great on plains. They're awful in water and in the mud. They become, what was a strength becomes a liability. So they're in the middle of this field, and all of a sudden this water starts rushing in, and they have nowhere to go, and they all die. God is rescuing his people. Except for one. We have the third part of our story, the general. Keep reading with me. Verse 17. The general ran away on foot. Now Sisera ran away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Remember the Kenites from verse 11 that seemed to be an ADHD one-off? Of all places, he ran into the town in the tent of this one tribe of people that split off from his people and moved north. And it says about these people in verse 17 that the king Jabin of Hazor, the king of the Canaanites, and the family of Heber the Kenite had made a peace treaty. That is not good. They made a peace treaty years and years ago. The father of this one girl made a peace treaty with the enemy of their people. That's an act of betrayal. It's the one thing God said don't do when you get into the land, because it's going to lead to sin. Don't make peace treaties with these people. Don't worship their gods. And the first thing these guys did, the father-in-law of Moses' people, they're his descendants, he got into the land and he said, let's make a treaty with the people around us. He was being passive when God said lead. And so the general finds his way into their camp, into this woman, Jael, verse 18. Jael came out to welcome Sisera. She said to him, stop and rest, my lord. Stop and rest with me. Don't be afraid. The text continues to say that he came into her tent and she said, hey, lay down, and made a comfortable bed. And he said, can I have some water? She said, have some milk instead. That's better. And she made him very comfortable. And he said, hey, if some men come looking for me, just tell them I'm not here. Continue on in the passivity and not the rescue of God that he has planned for your people. And she said, sure. That wasn't her entire plan. It gets a little graphic in verse 21. Then Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg in one hand and a hammer in the other. She crept up on him, drove the tent peg through his temple onto the ground, into the ground when he was asleep from exhaustion, and he died. So, again, it gets a little graphic. What happened was he fell asleep, and her plan all along was to kill this man. And we're not going to get into the ethical idea of whether God wanted her to kill him or not. That's not the point of the text. And there are some cases to be made if you read the end of chapter 5 that it was life or death for one of them, because when people conquered people, usually they raped and pillaged villages. And she wasn't going to have that happen to her. And what we see, though, is merely a reflection of what the writer wanted to get through with our story. That's what we have to do, understanding that I don't know if the text is condoning this behavior, but it is saying there was a purpose behind it. One commentator said, our ethical bones may cry out for some hint, but the writer includes no overt judgment, neither rationalization, condemnation, nor exoneration. Perhaps our textbook moral questions are not the central concern. The economics of a biblical writer, that is, what he admits or ignores or sometimes condenses, will frequently disclose what he does not think is important. What that means is there's a purpose. This is in the text, and the purpose is not to say that we should kill evil people. That's not here. We can have that conversation again later down the road. The purpose is why she did what she did and what it says about her story. And it says a couple things. One, I love that this comes back in the middle of it from verse 11. The writer, what he does is exceedingly throws this detail out there just to, when it gets brought back later on in the story, reminds us that God is faithful and God is sovereign. You ever have those moments? When you don't understand why things happen the way they happen, and then 10, 5, 8 years, months, days later, you look back and you realize that God knew what he was doing. So for me, thinking about this week, Andy talked about his wife. I don't know if you guys know this, but Andy has been trying to get me to leave this church for years. When we lived together, he wanted to plant a church and do worship. And so he'd always ask me, Charlie, when are we planting a church in Germany? When are we planting a church? Germany's not in flower mound. And so I'd say, yeah, I just don't know, man. And he got a job at another church for a while. And we did some things one-off together. And long story short, and it is a long story, ask him about it sometimes. We look back now and we see moving in together and we see the one or two things we did together just because we needed a music guy or a speaker as moments when God has been faithful to us and brought us to this point. When we might not have got it then, when things didn't work out like we thought it was going to, we look back and say, well, that was God being faithful when it seemed like it was not supposed to happen that way. Like there was a bit of ADHD. And then two, when we look at the story of this woman, what I think we see is the fact that our call towards leadership is not simply individualistic, but it's corporate. Because the story of Deborah isn't the story of one woman that saved her people. The story of Deborah is the story of one woman stepped into leadership, inspired somebody else who conquered a people, who then it got finished off by another woman who stepped into leadership and not passivity like your ancestors had done. The story of Deborah is a story of corporate leadership of a people to rescue and free an entire country. So it's like we just saw the picture of Mexico. I don't know if you guys have been to Mexico or heard about what happens in Mexico. I love that trip. But here's the deal. I like the first day the best. First day is concrete day. You get there, and for some reason, I love pouring concrete. I do. You mix it together, and then you get to float it. And it's like this artistic expression. You try to get it as smooth as possible, and when you're done, there is a slab. And that is my favorite part of the entire trip. From then, for me, the trip goes downhill. The second day is framing day. I hate framing. For the most part, because it's a reminder that high school girls can get nails into wood quicker than I can with less swings. It's a real big blow to my masculinity, right? And anyway, so after framing day is my least favorite day, which is stucco day. Stucco's awful. I don't know if you've worked with stucco. Stucco's this texture that we're not going to go into. It's just this awful brown texture that you sling onto walls, and usually more of it falls off the walls and sticks onto the walls. You need to be patient to like stucco. I am not. And you need to be okay with failure, because again, more falls than sticks and just keep on going. I do it twice and I'm done, right? I'm like, this isn't working. Let's find a better way. I hate stucco. I have worked with people whose favorite job is framing, and whose favorite job, and they're good at it, is stucco. They'll plug away at a wall for hours with no break. It's mind-numbingly boring to me. Why that matters is because at the end of the day, as we've stepped into different leaderships that God has put in front of us, probably with our giftings, what we see is a finished house. Constable said it well. He said, when God's people carry out their assigned responsibilities and cooperate, God grants success. Unfortunately, many good works flounder because the saints refuse to work together as God has gifted them. So these people all step in and step up. And their people, after 20 years of being oppressed by some chariots and not being able to walk down main streets or grow crops or flourish in any capacity, they finally have freedom. It says, and the land rested. And that leads to verse 1 in chapter 5. It's a song that Deborah wrote. And it starts like this. On that day, Deborah and Barak, son of Abinoam, sang this victory song. When the leaders took the lead in Israel, when the people answered the call to war, praise the Lord. That phrase, when the leaders took the lead in Israel, really just means when the people of Israel gave their total commitment to the purposes of God. It's a phrase of complete abandonment towards God's ways. It's a phrase that says, what we're supposed to do is not sit on the sidelines, but fully engage in God's mission of rescue. That's when we see him show up. There was an article I read yesterday. It was an op-ed piece. I think in the New York Times, I forget. And the headline got me reading it. It was a headline that said, I'm a former pastor, and I think you should stop going to church. And I thought to myself, come on, man. We don't need any more help with that. And as I read the article, it was one of those bait and switch things that Christians like to do. And so it really just said, I'm a former pastor, and the reason why you shouldn't go to church is because you should be the church. And he broke down numbers on how 80% of the work is done by 20% of the people, and it was just an article saying that maybe we've sat on the sidelines too long, and our job as Christians isn't to sit and watch, but to step up and engage in and with God's rescue mission so that we might see him move and work. It was an article that said, God needs godly leaders to do the job. And it's not about men and it's not about women. It's about gifting and God showing up when you don't think you're equipped enough to do it. It's about us saying, I will step up and lead, whatever that looks like. That might be in your family. That might be on Sunday morning. That might be brew crew. That might be ushers. That might be in one of the local communities that we serve with. But now more than ever, I think the church needs to not just individually step up and lead, but corporately say God's justice is worth pursuing. God's goodness is something we will fight for because he does. And what he calls us to be is not a church that comes and sits, but that steps up with him and engages with those around us. What he calls for is godly leadership. We are not called to be a passive people, but one that's engaged. And that's the story of Deborah and of Barak and of Jael. This God is begging us to step up and lead so that people might know who he is. And our whole narrative ends in verse 31 of chapter 5. It says, may all your enemies perish like this, O Lord, but may those who love you shine, and like the rising sun at its brightest. And the land had rest for 40 years. It's building to this idea that God's justice is rising, that God's justice is worth it, that God's justice is good, and that people see that justice and that people see that rescue when the people of God step up and lead. Let me pray. God, I'm thankful for stories that remind us that we're not just supposed to come here and sit on Sunday mornings, but to step up in leadership so that people might know you. I pray that it is not a shaming morning, but it's an encouraging one, because as we see the rescue of God unfolding, we become encouraged and excited about what you're doing and who you are. I pray that we might be a church that, as we told the story of God rescuing all morning long, that draws us into the goodness of God so that we might be reminded that you're a God of rescue, of faithfulness, of goodness, and of grace. As we keep worshiping, I pray that we remember those things. I pray that we know that you have called us into your mission of justice, and that you might show us where we need to step up and lead so that people might see Jesus. I pray these things in his name. Amen.